This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, two things that are certain, death and taxes.
I knew
right?
it.
And the end of life. Unfortunately, it's going to happen for all of us. And maybe we'll be lucky enough when it's time, age 95 or 99, that to die in our sleep. You do hear about that happening every once in a while.
That's right.
And that would be a great way to go, wouldn't it?
Well, if you have to choose, I suppose it would, yes.
Yeah. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen very often. What will likely happen is that the patient and or their family will need to make some end-of-life decisions when that time comes. Mm. Things like, do I want to be resuscitated? Do I want a feeding tube? What about a breathing tube? These are all issues that really do matter because sooner or later. So here's what we all need to do. We all need to communicate our wishes about our end-of-life medical care, what we want and what we don't want, to both our healthcare team and to our family. They all need to know. And you know what? It's not that hard. It's not that complicated.
It's just a conversation, even maybe. Yeah, today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk about advance directives or living wills or healthcare proxies and directives for organ donation with two specialists, Dr. Timothy Moynihan and nurse educator Ms. Cheryl Ness. We'll tell you what an advance directive can and should include, why everyone should have one, how you go about getting it done, and we'll get our experts' advice on how to choose a healthcare proxy, someone to speak for you if you are unable to do so.
All that coming up and a truly important topic.
But first, this week, longtime San Diego Padres retired right fielder Tony Gwynn died as a result of cancer of his mouth at the age of 54. Doctors told Gwynn that his longtime use of tobacco was not necessarily the cause of his specific cancer. But Gwynn himself was convinced, once saying, and I quote, "Of course it caused it. I always dipped on my right side." And that is the side where he got his cancer.
Yep.
So joining us now to discuss the effects of smokeless tobacco and if chewing tobacco may have contributed to his death, the treatment program coordinator for Mayo Clinic Nicotine Dependence Center, Dr. Michael Burke. Good morning, Dr. Burke.
Good morning.
Well, is there anything that I've read there isn't really a link between the two, but what do you say?
So he had cancer of the salivary gland, the parotid gland, which is up above really where the mouth is. And most people who chew tobacco get cancer of the tongue or the gum or someplace inside the mouth. So his was in a gland adjacent to it, right, Mr. Burke?
That's absolutely true. Yeah, parotid cancer, and that's a relatively rare cancer, maybe 5,000 or so cases a year in the United States, and there hasn't been shown to be a cause and effect between chewed tobacco and parotid cancer, but certainly between chewed tobacco and a number of other oral cancers and esophageal cancer, and even recently we're seeing pancreatic cancer.
How is it that baseball players, is it because their game moves so slowly that baseball players are always chewing tobacco?
Where does this? Bored.
Yeah, what do we know about that?
Well, that's what they say. They say, it's a slow-moving game and we're bored and that's why. But over 30% of the rookies when they come in are already addicted to chewed tobacco when they come into the major leagues anyway. And
30%?
Yeah, and and the average age of initiation is 12 or 13. So by the time they're in their 20s and in the major league, it's addiction. It's not just filling time.
So how is chewing tobacco different than smoking a cigarette when it comes to nicotine delivery?
Well, a cigarette is the best drug delivery device ever invented. Certainly, it delivers nicotine to the brain powerfully, and the cigarettes have been produced in a way to make the nicotine especially addicting and volatile.
Yeah, but it's because it's the quickest way to get the nicotine into the bloodstream, right?
Yep, and they add ammonia to what they call freebase, the nicotine, which makes it much more addicting. However, with smokeless tobacco, what looks like an innocuous product maybe is a well-designed mechanism to deliver nicotine to the brain, and we know that the tobacco industry has had marketing strategies by which they graduate people from slower deliveries of nicotine with some brands of chew tobacco up to higher brands where they're more addicted, so they learn to tolerate the nicotine, and they boost the nicotine delivery in chew tobacco, usually using sodium bicarbonate or other chemicals like that.
I have known people who are smokers who try to quit smoking by transitioning into chewing tobacco on their way to quitting at some point, but most of them usually never do.
People who are addicted to chew tobacco have a really serious addiction. It's very hard to stop. And it's not a safe transition away from cigarettes. You know, we do have medications and nicotine replacements that are proven to be safe and effective in helping people quit. And that's really what we recommend. Chew tobacco isn't safe, and there are better ways to quit, for sure.
What's the most common location that you see? Is it cancer of the tongue or the mouth or the gum or the tonsil? Or where do you see it most commonly in tobacco chewers?
I don't know that. I'm not a cancer expert. I'm a tobacco treatment expert.
You want to get them off of this so that this never happens.
Yes, you know, and before cancer, frequently people will develop leukoplakia, white or red spots in the gum and cheek, and we want to help them stop before they face any of those problems.
So that's because that is a precancerous lesion.
Sure is.
Right.
And is there any certain, I don't know, struggles that people who chew tobacco have trying to give it up as opposed to smokers?
There are certainly different rituals that they have. The addiction is similar, but how they go about using it, the different triggers that they need to manage are different. That's why it can help to talk to a specialist either by phone or in person, or talk to your doctor, because you develop plans to manage what's particular for you. So there are differences between smokeless tobacco and smoking tobacco, but there are many differences that smokeless tobacco users have in how they use. And so their treatment and their plan for quitting might be a little bit different.
So you've got a lot of different ways to help people, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us. And we know you're getting ready for a graduation party at your home. So we appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. We'll take a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with two experts on advanced directives, Dr. Timothy Moynihan and Ms. Cheryl Ness, plus myth or matter of fact. An advanced directive means do not treat.
Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our guest at 507-282-1234 or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us at any time. Hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae. And today's topic is advanced directives. What you want your family and your healthcare team to know about how you want to die. That's sort of crass, isn't it?
Well, it's an important conversation that needs to be had, that's for sure.
Okay, well, today's guests are both experts on advanced directives. Dr. Timothy Moynihan, an oncologist and also works in palliative medicine at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Moynihan, welcome back. Always good to have you on the program.
Great, Tom. Great to see you again. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And Ms. Cheryl Ness, who is a nurse educator and an assistant professor of oncology at the Mayo Clinic. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start out and put it in as simple terms as you can. What is an advance directive, or what we sometimes call a living will? It's really a dying will, isn't it?
Actually, no, I think living will is probably the correct term for it, because we usually think of these near the end of life, but the idea is this is a way to allow you to stay in control of your health care, even if you cannot speak for yourself. So first of all, it doesn't come into effect until that time as you can't speak for yourself, because as long as you can speak for yourself, we'll just speak to you and ask you what you want done. However, if ever comes a time when you can't speak for yourself because of a head injury, dementia, or some other process, then we have an idea of what kind of treatments you would want. This could include somebody might say, I never wanted to be on a dialysis machine, or it could include exactly the opposite. As long as my heart's beating, I want you to do everything. Fine. Either way, whatever it is, put that down so that your doctors don't have to make guesses, so we don't have to turn to other family members to make decisions for you, so we know how you want to be treated, and we'll treat you the way you want to.
Right. And Cheryl, what's your role here? How do you help people through this process?
Well, exactly. I work in the Cancer Education Center, and many times we are the people who, at times of crisis, where people come to and say, you know, I was just diagnosed with a terminal cancer, or I've just been diagnosed with something really life-threatening, and I need to make some decisions about a living will because they're asking me about this. So we help them find the tools and have that conversation, but it's in a time when they're, you know, really not, it's not the best time to have that conversation. It's better to do it when you are thinking clearly and you can really make a good decision.
Well, and because rather than being in crisis, family has to be in agreement.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen very often, does it? Or does it? I always imagine that there's going to be some, one child wants this and somebody else wants that. And how often does that happen? More often than not?
Well, you know, we always like that to be the case, but even if you think it might work out, many times it doesn't.
Hmm.
And so I really encourage people to talk to their families and write these things down through this living will and create their advanced directives, which is really this umbrella term. So many people really, it's confusing. And I think that's the other reason why people don't address this right away, is it's confusing because there's advanced directives, which is that umbrella term.
And what can that include, and what should it include? Your advanced directives consists of what?
From my perspective, and Dr. Moynihan, please also chime in here, but it includes a living will, which is the primary piece.
And that's where you say, I want this, this, and this, and I don't want this, this, and this,
exactly.
Right? And that's something that you talk to your healthcare provider about and your family about, and they can help you make those decisions, right?
Exactly.
So that's the living will part of it.
That's the living will.
Okay, and what else goes into an advanced directive?
Also, you want to appoint someone to make decisions when you're not able to, and that's that healthcare proxy or healthcare power of attorney. And that's a really important decision as well, to choose someone who you trust and you've talked to about your wishes. But it also, you know, advanced directives can also include things like organ donation and those kind of decisions. So you have to kind of think of these things in little pieces and take one thing at a time. You know, start with the living will idea and work through some of those decisions and then decide who you want to be that trusted person that would make decisions if you weren't able to.
All right. Once you name a proxy in an advanced directive, you lose control of your own care. Myth or matter of fact?
That is clearly a myth. Once you have an advanced directive, again, as long as you're able to speak for yourself, you can change your mind anytime you want. You can change the advance directive as often or as seldom as you wish to do. And again, that may evolve over the course of your health. What you want when you're 35 may be very different than what you want when you're 95. Mm-hmm. So I think we consider this a living document, something that's going to change with time. And you do not necessarily lose control of that. You can always change your mind. Now, however, if you are in a situation where you can't speak for yourself, we turn to the living will to try and make decisions as you would had you been able to speak to us at that time.
How do you go about choosing a proxy? Who might that person be?
I think the important thing about choosing a proxy is that somebody who knows you, knows your preferences, and that you've communicated well with. One of the key things about choosing a proxy is most people have more than one very important person in their life. It can be a spouse, can be children, brothers, sisters, family, pastors, etc. So there are many different people involved in life. And if you name a specific proxy, then it can help decrease some of the arguments that go on. Because your uncle from California may want this, and your aunt from Louisiana may want this, and your wife may want some different thing. And if we know who to turn to, they can be the arbiter of this. It also really helps if we know what your specific wishes were, because we can say, listen, this is what your loved one wrote down, and this is what they want. And we just want to follow what they tell us to. Again, whether it be to do all kinds of things or whether it be to focus more on comfort only.
Advanced directives are legally binding, so doctors have to follow them. Myth or matter of fact?
This is also a myth. The advanced directives laws change from state to state. So there are some states where they are legally binding and they should be followed. But it really is so situationally dependent as to what the condition is that's making the patient not be responsive. Some of these things are very readily reversible, and people would want those things to be done. Other conditions are clearly irreversible, and patients may not want treatments in that time.
So then what's the point of having it written down?
Again, the writing it down is for a guidance, mm. so we can try and follow the patient's wishes to the best of our ability. Now, if a patient clearly has made it clear that they really do not want to be resuscitated, the healthcare professions are obligated to respect that to the best of our ability. We, again, often have conflicts where family members may come in
yeah.
and dispute that and say, no, that's not what he really wanted. And we have to negotiate our way through that, because we do have to pay attention to the family, but our obligation is still to the patient.
And that is that do not resuscitate we were talking about last week during our emergency and cardiac care program. Most people are wearing a bracelet that says do not resuscitate, or where do you get that information, Cheryl?
Well, I think that's a really important point. We talk a little bit about that with patients. Sometimes it's a bracelet that they would wear. Other times, the refrigerator is
yeah.
a good place to put
a sign on the refrigerator. Okay.
Or just an indication that this is their wish. Because at that point, the emergency responders are also really, really trying to make that best decision for the person. And their primary goal really is to treat.
So who should have copies of this? Once you get it done, you've got a living will and you've appointed a healthcare proxy, I assume it becomes part of the medical record. But who else should have copies of these documents?
I think it's really important to remember where you place these documents. They need to be in a place where people can find them. I've heard of people putting a little note in their billfold, for example, the same place where they would keep their driver's license, that says, I have a living will and here's where it is. I know in my family, it's always in the Bible.
Oh, really?
So that's like the place where we put all of our important things. So that's where we look. But
Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John.
Exactly. No, but it needs to be in a place. It shouldn't be in a safe deposit box. It shouldn't be filed away somewhere where no one can find it. And especially your proxy needs to know, you know, they need to have a copy. And others, if you would like them to have a copy, people that are important to you should know where this is.
We're pretty close to be able, I'm sure there's people who have this, that you could mm-hmm. have it on a little microfile and have it on a card in your billfold.
Exactly.
That you could say, here it is, and scan it, and there it is.
Well, there must be an app for this, isn't it? Don't you have it on your smartphone?
I think there probably is, yes.
I know that you want to tell us about some resources where people can go that will help them do their advanced directives. Can you give us those?
That is really, you know, so many times we get those questions like, how do I start? And I have two resources that I really love. There are many others, I'm sure, but one of them is called Caring Connections. It's a website you can find at caringinfo.org. And they have really, like, how to start your advanced directives. Here are the different components. They have forms that you can kind of work through to help you create this. And they also connect you to state-specific living
wow.
will and advanced directive laws and different changes, and you know, you can understand from your state what's, you know, what to do. The other really, really interesting perspective is something called Five Wishes. This is from the agingwithdignity.org, and it really outlines five wishes, and this helps you create what you would like. And the wishes are, the first wish is you want the person to, you know, who is the person I want to make care decisions for me when I can't. The second is, what's the kind of medical treatment I want or don't want? And then the third is, how comfortable I want to be. fourth is, how do I want people to treat me? And the fifth is, what I want my loved ones to know. So it really goes beyond the planning of the living will to end of life and takes it to that level too. But it's a really thoughtful way of doing that. And you can access that five wishes on agingwithdignity.org.
Okay, agingwithdignity.org. And the other website was?
caringinfo.org.
All right, myth or matter of fact, I need a lawyer to do an advance directive.
In the state of Minnesota, the answer to that is no. And in most states, that is not true. The regulations of Minnesota is that you do have to have two witnesses sign this. And they do not have to be a notary public. They do have to be adults. And they cannot be a paid caregiver, a professional caregiver who's actually caring for you at that time. Again, the regulations do change from state to state, but most states do not require a lawyer to do this, nor do they require a notary signature.
All right, we have a minute remaining before our break. Tell us why more people don't do this. What are the barriers to getting this done?
I think the number one barrier is probably fear. People are afraid of dying. That's one of the inborn fears that we have. That's one of the greatest fears that people do have. So I think one of the coping mechanisms for things we're afraid of is avoidance, and we tend to do that. I know I'm going to live forever. I mean, Tom, I know you're going to die someday, but I'm never going to die.
Don't be so sure.
Okay. But you're right. You know, that's the one thing guaranteed to us in life is we are going to die someday. So we just don't like to think of it because it's an uncomfortable subject, but it's a very important subject to deal with. Now, what's interesting is those people who do have an advance directive, 70 to 80% of them do not let their physicians know about their advance directive, and 70 to 80% of them do not let their family know that they have an advance directive.
Really?
Now, yet it's still only a minority of people who ever do fill out advance directives, but those who do don't let anybody know about it.
Interesting.
We need to do better. Good thing we're talking about
this. That's right.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests are both experts on advance directives.
Timothy Moynihan and Ms. Cheryl Ness. And coming up this week, this week's medical news from Vivian Williams. And then we'll take your phone calls and questions at 507-282-1234. And your tweets, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Tick season continues to be in full bloom, and you likely know that getting bitten by a tick can cause Lyme disease. Well, that's not all. People who get bitten by a black-legged tick have a higher than expected chance of being exposed to more than one pathogen at the same time. That's according to research published in the journal PLOS ONE. The researchers found ticks are almost twice as likely to be infected with two things: the bacteria that causes Lyme disease and the protozoan that causes babesiosis. Lyme disease can cause a rash at the tick site that looks like a bullseye, flu-like symptoms, and joint pain. Babesiosis causes flu-like symptoms. Now, this means healthcare providers and the public need to be particularly alert to the possibility of multiple infections coming from the same tick bite. And from Mayo Clinic, researchers examined the physical act of reading to see if practicing eye movements in school could lead to better early reading fluency. Rapid eye movements are required for the physical act of reading. Previous studies have shown that eye movements are not fully developed at the age when children begin to learn to read. Eye movements in younger kids are imprecise, so they need to make their eyes go back and forth to read text, leading to slower reading rate and poor reading fluency. And it may affect reading comprehension and academic performance. Here's Dr. Amal Starling.
What that might mean is there might be a critical learning period during that kindergarten to third grade time where we can get our biggest bang for our buck, kind of, so to speak, where if we can teach the physical act of reading, that we can actually make a huge improvement in reading fluency and make a huge impact on, you know, the youth and education.
Well, this next story has a big wow factor. A man with almost no hair on his body has grown a full head of it after a new treatment by doctors at Yale University. The man had alopecia, an incurable disease that left him hairless. Now, this is the first reported case of a successful targeted treatment for this condition. He also grew hair in his face and body. The treatment was a drug for rheumatoid arthritis. Now, the researchers hope to start clinical trials to see if this drug in cream form works for other people. And finally, sunscreen. We know it protects from sunburn, but there's been questions about whether it reduces the risk of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. Well, research from Texas Biomedical Research Institute shows, yes, it does. They found the incidence of malignant melanoma in adulthood can be reduced by the consistent use of sunscreen in infancy and childhood. So, lather up before you go out. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know, on air, online, and we're on iHeartRadio. And you can listen live to us on your smartphone at radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can go to krocam.com, hit the menu button, and there we are.
Just find us. We're everywhere.
That's right. Time for you to join our conversation. It is on Advanced Directives, Living Wills, Healthcare Proxies. You can contact us with your questions and comments by telephone at 507-282-1234, or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can always tweet us. We take a lot of those. Hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. 507-282-1234. Dave has a question. Good morning, Dave. Go right ahead.
Yes. We have a document we prepared with our attorney. It's called a healthcare directive. We have another document that is printed by Mayo Clinic. It's titled an advanced directive, but in the document, the wording says, by signing this healthcare directive. So the point I'm making is those two terms seem to be really bound together.
Yeah, interchangeable.
Yeah, good point, Dave. And that's why it's confusing, as you guys mentioned. Yeah, so let's get this straightened out. Dr. Moynihan?
Yeah, are they interchangeable?
Oftentimes these words are used somewhat interchangeably, unfortunately, and so it does get fairly confusing there. I think the key point is that, again, we understand what things you want and what things you do not want. And I think that's the more important thing. And what the actual formal title of it is, I think it's less important rather than what direction you want us to take. I think as long as you have it written down, again, to actually have these directives written down, you don't even need to write them down. If you communicate these to your physicians can put this in their progress note and refer to that and use that as a source of documentation for what your requests are.
The form printed by Mayo Clinic titled An Advanced Directive also has, it's a special form for that. It has a subtitle, Permission for Postmortem Examination.
That's slightly different, and that's one of the parts of an overall advance directive, is that after you die, would you want an autopsy performed? As a part of this also is the question about organ donation. If you die and have the ability to donate your organs, would you want that? Some people, for religious or cultural reasons, would not want that. Some people would very much want and appreciate their organs being used to help somebody else in the event of their death.
Thanks for calling in, Dave.
Yeah, thank you.
Important point. So, yeah, it is confusing for people because there are probably a majority of people out there who really want to do this, but they don't know how to go about it. And the terms are confusing. Didn't it used to be that we just called it a living will? And in that living will, you named a healthcare proxy and you told what you wanted done, didn't want done. Now there's all these different terms. So don't you understand why it's confusing for people?
Yeah, we in medicine try to make things as confusing as we possibly can. I think that's part of our job, unfortunately. We don't really intend to do that, but that does occur. But I think you can look at both of these in somewhat different ways. The living will is really, you know, how do you want to be treated? Advanced directive is supposed to go to more direct methods as to what medical treatments you want or do not want. Again, the living will seems to be somewhat a broader topic, including some other things that you may want. Some people are also bringing up the idea of you may want an ethical will, too. You have your financial will, where you want your money to go. You may have your advanced directive as to how you want to be treated when you can't speak for yourself. But Dr. Barry Baines from up in the cities has developed what's called an ethical will, too. And so what are your values? What are your resources? How do you want to be remembered? What are the things that are important to you as you go forward with your life? These may be important things to put down also to leave a legacy for your family.
See, I told you it would be a lot easier to die in your sleep.
Well, part of what is interesting also is, you know, the first time I ever made my living will, I was in my 30s. And someone who makes their advance directive up when they're in their 30s, if they want to revisit that, of course, I would think you would, because I can take out the part about who's going to take care of my kids if something happens to me. Or, you know, as you get older, I would think that your thoughts would change as you see your friends die or experiences that you have that you want to change it. So how easy is it to go then and change an advance directive?
Well, I think that's a really good point, and it's important to consider that you really should be looking at that every so often as your life, you know, moves on.
10 years?
Whenever there's a change, every five or ten years, I think it's a really good thing. Just the fact that you started when you were 30, I'm so excited to hear that because so many people just don't even think about it when they're young, and that's, you know, one of the things that we really try to really stress. So I would say every 5 to 10 years, and especially when something happens that you really need to consider, you know, I'm in this situation now, so it might change how I feel about my health care. It might change how I feel about maybe my values and beliefs have changed since I was 30 years old.
About every time you get a colonoscopy, you can review that while you're doing the prep the night before.
Well, I did mine right after we had our daughter, because when you have kids, everything changes. You have to mix everything up, and so that was the beginning for me.
And it is really important to do it when you're young, because if you think about the cases that make the headlines and the cases that make the news, there tend to be very young people who don't have an advance directive. The Terry Schiavos and the Carrie Ann Quinlans of the world. These are very tragic cases. And if they had an advance directive in either direction, either that would say, I don't want a feeding tube, I do want a feeding tube, I want to be an event, I don't want to be an event, doesn't matter what they put down. Had they had that, there would be no controversy and you never would have heard their names.
507-282-1234. We have a few questions. Good morning, Gladys. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead with your question.
Well, I think it was just answered. I don't have a terminal illness or even a chronic illness, but I was wondering if there's any point in me filling out a living will, but I think you just answered it.
No, it's true. We all should have one. Every single one of us should, because we don't really know what's going to happen from day to day. And it's those moments, especially those moments we don't expect, where we need to have that assurance that our wishes would be are known to people, and that we would be cared for the way we would choose to. And it really is a gift to your family. Consider it a huge gift. Your family won't have to go through what some of these families are going through in the news.
Yeah, I was going to say, Gladys, that when I would hear about Terry Schiavo, I would just think, well, imagine Terry Schiavo's family, that what they're going through and how they're fighting over it and they're agonizing over it. So, yeah, it sounds like something you should do.
Thanks. You're young, Gladys, but you're not too young to do this.
Okay, thanks.
Hey,
you bet.
Thanks for calling.
507-282-1234. Beth is on the line. Go ahead with your question, Beth.
Top of the morning, team. Wonderful program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As mobile as I have been with each professional position I have accepted in a different state, I have created that directive that we're talking about right now. Now, in this day and age when so many of us, professionally or personally, are so mobile, here I am in Rochester, Minnesota. I have all of my legal documents here, but what happens if I need to professionally be in an international country, if I need to be in another state, and I am involved in a critical situation where the medical team doesn't know what or who?
Sure.
Hey, Beth,
so
good question.
What should she do?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And one, I would say, carry with you, if you are traveling and you know it, a copy of your living will, or have it accessible in some way through your medical record so that people can get a hold of it. Now, the laws do change from state to state. And we can't get into the details of all 50 states, and that's why this caring organization has the state-specific information that we referred to. But in general, if you have a living will in one place, the physicians from the other state will probably pay close attention to that, so they know your directives. Whether or not it's legally binding may be a slightly separate question. And there are certain regulations in certain states that tell us what we can and can't do. For example, there's a recent case in Texas where a young woman who was pregnant had an advance directive spelling out what she would or would not want had she become comatose or, or brain damaged. And unfortunately, this, the law in Texas, and I believe in Louisiana and a few other states, says that if a woman is pregnant, her living will is no longer valid and cannot be followed.
Oh, no, that further confuses the issue.
Absolutely. So it is really a state-to-state issue. But I think as a general rule, most physicians in other states would respect the directives from some other state because it is your wishes that we're trying to follow.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Beth. We just had a question tweeted into us. Can you talk about a medical power of attorney into allowing for intubation when advanced directives say do not resuscitate or do not intubate?
So, in other words, can a physician take over and override the power of attorney?
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple situations where that can happen. The most common one is in an emergency situation where it's somewhat unclear what the DNR or DNI status is.
DNR is do not resuscitate, DNI?
And DNI means do not intubate or do not put the breathing tube down.
So intubation, it's a breathing tube.
The DNR represents do not try to restart the heart if it's stopped. And so in an emergency situation where the directives are unclear, the physicians are allowed to proceed with what they feel the most reasonable person would want in that setting until they can understand what the underlying process is and if and what the true advance directives are. If it is a situation where the advance directives are very clear and they say do not intubate, do not resuscitate, the physicians should follow that, and legally they are obliged to do that. There's no physician thus far who has been either charged or prosecuted with not following those directives. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't always been settled in the courts because it hasn't been challenged in the courts. But the physician is obliged to do what is in their best interest and what they feel is the best interest of the patient at the time, including pay attention to those advanced directives.
I had a friend who, the question when we were talking about this, said, the problem I don't know is how many days should this be? 30 days, 60 days, you're supposed to put, fill in the blank with how many days you want to be on a feeding tube before you say, all right, the brain really is not going to come back. Is that a problem that families have, is trying to figure out how many days do we go?
It can be, and this is not something that's necessary to put into these advanced directives. It's one thing that might give some guidance, and it's one way for some people to make decisions. Another way is some people defer the decision to physicians, and they say, if my physician and two other physicians feel that I have an irreversible condition, I would want to continue on a life support machine, or I would not want to continue on this, or I would want artificial feedings, or I wouldn't want artificial feedings. So one way to help get around this is say, I would defer this decision in that situation to these trusted physicians that I have.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, and an important point that Cheryl brought out is that this can be revised over time. If you want to revoke it or you want to change it after you've already signed it, that can be done, easily done.
Yeah, and I think that's a fear that a lot of people have is when they sign it, it's going to be there forever and they can never change it. And that is something that, is totally flexible. You can change it whenever you feel like it.
Very good. Becca is on the line with a question. A great question. Good morning, Becca. Go right ahead.
Hi, thanks. Something that's kind of come up with my own folks is it possible to have a DNI, do not intubate order, but not a DNR? So we're basically thinking of, if mom's pulse stops, can we try minimal stuff to try to get her back without doing the full code?
That's always an interesting point, and it does get to be a very difficult one. And yes, it is possible to have one without the other. I think the bottom line really is what is it we're trying to accomplish, and will these treatments accomplish that? If you have a condition that makes your heart stop, what is the chance of trying to restart that will help that? The other thing I think that people don't realize is if we do have something like try to resuscitate somebody, especially if we're talking about older people or people who have chronic health conditions, when we try to restart the heart, first of all, it's a very violent procedure. We very frequently break 6 to 8 ribs in people when we try to restart the heart. Getting the shocks to the heart hurts, and patients who have had these shocks while they're awake tell it's extremely painful. And again, will going through this procedure be worth it to change what the outcome is going to be? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a very difficult balance we have to choose. We generally recommend against this piecemeal, or some people call it a Chinese menu type of thing, you know, one from column A and two from column B kind of thing, because that usually ends up with more confusion and more difficulty. So I think it's very important to sit down and speak with your healthcare professional as to what these treatments might do and would these things help. If they help and they accomplish your goal, fine, do it. If they're not going to accomplish your goal, consider the price you have to pay to get to that.
Thank you, Becca.
Thanks.
Very good. How much have pacemakers changed advanced directives? Because you have to shut off a pacemaker, right?
Pacemakers have changed advanced directives a lot. And Dr. Paul Mueller here is actually one of the international world experts on this, and he's researched this a lot. Pacemakers by themselves were really not much of an issue because they will continue to pace the heart until the battery wears out. But that's not a painful thing. What's more important is these implantable defibrillators, because when the heart stops, this will start to fire and it will try and defibrillate the patient and shock the patient continuously until that battery wears out.
An internal shocker as opposed to the AED, which is from the outside.
Exactly. It's an internal shocker as opposed to an external shocker.
But you don't feel it, or do you feel it?
No, the patient definitely feels it. And again, patients who are awake when these things fire say it's very, very painful and very disturbing.
Is that right?
In addition, if your loved one dies and has one of these in place and you're holding your hand, you will get shocked also. And it is again, a fairly violent thing. So,
and you can't turn it off,
yes,
right?
You can turn it off.
You can?
Yes, you can turn it off. And so in our advanced care planning, one of the things we do in people who have implantable defibrillators, we ask, when is the time to turn this off? Because it is a fairly simple thing to do. It doesn't require an operation. It's a simple device that can adjust the defibrillator. And we can turn off the defibrillator portion, but leave the pacemaker portion in place. But so, again, will the shocks achieve the goal that the patient has? If they will, fine, do it. If they don't, especially near the end of life, it is important to turn that off because it's very traumatic for the family to do this. In those situations where we don't have that, we can just place a magnet over the thing to turn things off in an emergency situation.
All right, you can turn it off. The patient can't turn it off.
The patient can turn it off, and the family can be instructed on how to turn it off with magnets.
Wow.
All right, Cheryl, once more, the two resources that you like to help people with advanced directives.
They are 5 Wishes from agingwithdignity.org and Caring Connections from caringinfo.org.
All right, Cheryl Ness, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate
you.
Your time. And Dr. Timothy Moynihan, always good to have you on the program. Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks, Tom. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back next week on Mayo Clinic Radio. Healthy eating made easy. That's like healthy eating for dummies.
I don't know if this is possible.
Well, I don't either.
Yeah. Is it fat? Is it sugar? What is it that's salt? Is salt going to kill us? I don't even know anymore.
Well, dietitian Miss Kate Zaratsky is going to tell us that it is possible. You know, there's an epidemic of obesity in this country. You know that. 2/3 overweight, 1/3 obese. I mean, what's wrong with this country? I mean, what is wrong with our culture?
Yeah, I heard this week I was watching something on the news, and my daughter especially, they said 70% of adults are obese. And that all of a sudden just struck her, and she said, how can that even be possible?
Well, unfortunately, it is. You know what? But the problem, it's easy. It's really simple. It's straightforward. It's too many calories in and not enough calories out. Well, next week with our dietitian, we'll tell you how to eat healthy without being a gourmet cook and why you should always be thinking fruits and vegetables and everything about fat, carbohydrates, salt, everything you wanted to know about healthy eating made easy next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
And you know that they're changing it up a little bit. It used to be 5 fruits and vegetables a day. Now it's up to 7.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Tom.
I was hoping you'd say four.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed today, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of the program and all the information we discussed. Or go to mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Tim Moynihan and Ms. Cheryl Ness, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know. We'll be right back.